Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Gathered here today to worship at the altar of music and comedy. The giddiness and the harmony of a well-crafted comedy song brings great joy in abundance. Join the tinkling talents of David Timms and me, Phil Nickel. Sit back, turn it up, and enjoy Songs in the Key of Laugh.
Yes,
hey.
It is Songs the Key of Laugh. It's Series 3. It's Episode 2. We are rocking right into this.
We are rocking. That's Man, exactly what we're doing today,
Episode
Phil.
1 with Johnny and the Baptist. That was what a great interview.
I absolutely love that band.
Adore those boys. And as you probably recognize, our regular listeners, thank you for coming back. We've got some ads on the podcast now.
We do.
Because we've now got enough listeners, we can monetize.
Oh, yeah, monetize.
Which I know it seems like a bad word, and we'd be doing it for free anyway, but it's nice that David and I can actually make a little extra money. He has a baby.
I do. And that baby has no shoes.
It's got no shoes. It's got one shoe now.
Well, yeah.
After last week's show. And we're also, you can catch us on Patreon, because we've got this great idea now that we're going to put our episodes out a week early. For those of you that are eager to hear the episodes, you can just join our Patreon, and for a very small amount of money helping David and I make the show, you'll get the show a week earlier than anyone else.
And you'll also get some bonus content as well.
We're going to be adding loads of bonus content.
Oh, yeah, bonus content.
And once, thanks again to Acast for housing us and this podcast. Guys, we hope this is, I'm excited about this episode. Coming up in this episode, we've got, as usual, our comedy song contest. We're going to attempt to write in nativity.
We're going to continue with our nativity.
It's our dictionary, improv dictionary musical. And we've got a great guest. And she's new. She's hip. She's fantastically talented. And her name is Amy Weber.
So I wrote a song. At the time, I had a ukulele, which I bought to help me with my teaching. I used to teach one day a week in a primary school doing musical workshops. And so I had this ukulele and I was like, fuck it, I'll just write my own 2-minute song where I go, my name's Amy Weber, I will be a great singer for you. And I sing opera and I sing jazz and then I sing it. Anyway, I performed this song and everyone laughed. And like, obviously it was funny because I was kind of showing off and I would sing things like, I can sing slowly and beautifully. And it was all just sort of kind of showy offy, but in a silly way. Also a bit sort of taking the piss out of myself.
Yes.
As you have to be if you're ever going to show off. Otherwise, it's just crass and horrible.
Yeah. So stick around and listen to that interview, because Amy's fascinating, fascinating human being.
She is, absolutely. Now, Phil, I wanted to talk to you about somebody who has passed away recently.
Oh, who's that?
Jerry Lee Lewis.
Jerry Lee Lewis.
That yes. Sensational keys player.
The killer. He was called The Killer.
Is that what he was called?
That was his nickname, Jerry Lee Lewis, The Killer.
Ah, he's...
Bit controversial,
to say the least.
Married his cousin.
Yeah, wasn't she about 12?
12. Yeah, let's move on.
Okay.
So the 1950s were an interesting time.
They were really an interesting time.
And there was a light, like, post-war... You know, the American economy was booming.
Post-war. This is like your era, isn't it? Were you around in the...
Yeah, I was just finished university at that point, David. Asshole. And, but we were... I've been listening to sort of... Today we're going to talk about 1950s comedy songs. But I think, like, 1948, the first UFOs were discovered. I didn't realize it was that recent.
When you say the first UFOs were discovered.
Well, that's the first time people were made a big, there was a big hoo-ha about UFOs.
You can't say they were discovered, because surely then there had to have been UFOs. Were there UFOs? Do you believe in UFOs, Phil?
Unidentified flying objects. I believe in that, because that's what they are. They're now called, what are they called? They're now called unidentified aerial something or other. I should look that up. I was going to say OAPs, unidentified flying elderly people.
You imagine loads and loads of old pensioners with their Zimmer frames in the air.
Unidentified aerial phenomenon. That's what I was. That's why I couldn't get the because UAP and then P is hard and but phenomena.
P is hard. Phenomena, it's a hard letter.
Phenomena. Do. Anyway, so that's the 1950s. That's how it started with this crazy idea. You know, War of the Worlds. There were Martians in this whole, and because recording was becoming more and more professional, there was a guy for Novelty Records were a big thing. In the 50s. And there was a guy that owned Novelty Records or worked for Novelty Records called Ross Bagdasarian Jr., who invented this method where you were able to speed up his voice or speed up the recordings on his own and then have these like high voices. And he put out a song called The Witch Doctor, which was like a number one hit. And it sounds like this.
I told the witch doctor I was in love with you. I told the witch doctor I was in love with you. And then the witch doctor, he told me what to do. He said that...
From that was in like mid-1950s, I think. In the 1958, the same guy with his wife had this idea to do the Chipmunks. To use their voice.
No.
And they invented Alvin and the Chipmunks. And they invent this whole world. I think they had a fake dad called Dave Seville. So it became Dave Seville of the Chipmunks. And they weren't an animated thing like that. They were like a puppet show. So it was created just from this one simple technique of being able to slow the track, the tape down. I'm assuming that's what they did. And then that makes your voice, when you speed it back up to normal, your voice is, sounds high.
Yeah.
That's what that high voice came from. And so they did Alvin and the Chipmunks. And I think that's it. Ross's wife also did some of the voices in it. And that became really successful. They did it on Ed Sullivan. They traveled over the world. And now, of course, we know Alvin and the Chipmunks. It's like a huge franchise. I wonder if Ross Bagdasarian made all the money from that. That's wild. Listen to this.
All right, you chipmunks. Ready to sing your song?
I'll say we are. Yeah, let's sing it now.
Okay, Simon?
Okay.
Okay, Theodore?
Okay.
Okay, Alvin? Alvin?
Alvin!
Okay! Christmas, Christmas, time is near. Time for toys and time for cheer.
The Chipmunks went on to win, like, you know, heaps and heaps of, like, Billboard top, like, 5 Grammy Awards. 4 top 10 albums. Like, I mean, the Chipmunk song became the best-selling single of all time. And that's just by the simple idea of... He just thought, if I slow the tape down, I can speed it up. I wonder how he came across that. But that... To bring it all back to the UFO theme,
yeah,
that all came back round for one of the greatest-selling songs of all time by a guy called Cheb Woolley, because he used the same technique on a song called One-Eyed, One-Horned, Flying Purple People Eater, which was about aliens coming to Earth and then an alien coming to Earth, joining a rock band and being an amazing rock and roll horn player.
Bless my soul, rock and roll, flying purple people eater, pigeon toad, undercoat, flying purple people eater.
I like short shorts.
Flying purple people eater. What a sight to see.
Purple people.
Well, he went on his way and then what do you know? I saw him last night on a TV show. He was blowing it out, really knocking him dead. Playing rock and roll music through the horn in his head.
Okay, that's amazing, Phil. When you asked me to have a little look at the 1950s, obviously slightly different for me as I wasn't there. But I found somebody.
Yeah, you found someone.
I found somebody very, very, very cool. Stan Freberg.
Yes.
Have you ever heard of Stan Freberg?
No. Well, I mean, yes, because you mentioned him before we went to air. You asked me the same question about half an hour ago.
Okay, cool. Well, Stan Freberg, very, really, really important person.
Dave. Tell me about Stan Freberg.
I will tell you about Stan Freberg. So Stan Freberg, when he was 18, he had a really big opportunity to go to Stanford Uni, and he'd been given a scholarship. And instead of doing that, he said to his dad, who was a minister, he said, "I actually, just before I go off and do university, I'd like to go and make my name in Hollywood."
Wow.
So he got on a bus from Pasadena,
yep,
went to Hollywood, and he was the only person left on the bus. And he said, "Can you drop me in the very middle of Hollywood, please?" And so the bus driver stopped the bus and let him out. And then there was this agency, literally, yeah, where he'd been dropped off, which was like New Talent Agents. And he was like, "Ah, that's me. I can do that." So he then went in, said, "I can do all of these different voices." And the person there said, "Okay, show me your voices." He did, right, a few of them. They were really, really good.
Yep.
And he said, "Let's go to Warner Bros." And, wow, from Warner Bros., this guy then went on to Disney, worked with Walt Disney,
yep,
did voices for so many different cartoons,
yep,
but also wrote amazing novelty songs,
wow,
and also did loads and loads of parody.
Yes.
But whilst doing all of this, he also found that he was somebody who could do advertising.
Right.
So people would come to him and say, "What should we do to advertise prunes?" Right, you can't, right, can't imagine anything more boring to advertise.
Sure.
And so he did an advert on it,
yeah,
and he completely and utterly took the piss out of it.
Yes.
And in taking the piss out of it, managed to improve the sales of prunes by 40% the first advert and 200% the second time.
Wow.
So then he's been then up until probably like 2000 or something, he was still used to make all of these adverts.
Amazing.
He did adverts for soup, which would be with like 40 dancing girls going crazy and just completely and utterly off the wall.
Yeah.
But this man, Stan Freberg, really, really, really important person in like American voiceover history and in comedy history.
Yes.
So this is one of his songs. This is a song that he wrote because he wanted to show a soap opera, and he wanted to show a soap opera how simple it really, really was. And this song was banned in Australia. I think it was also banned in the States.
Banned. Isn't it amazing the way comedians, cutting edge, that's the cutting edge. You're going to get banned. You've got to be doing something very, very, very naughty.
Well, in this song, he only says two words, and they are John and Marsha.
John, Marcia, John, Marcia, John, Marcia, John, Marcia. John, Marcia, John, Marcia, John.
So please do go and check out Stan Freberg. Also, he did so many different skits of songs as well, which are, yeah, really, really, really funny. So go and check those out. But Phil, yeah, I'd love to hear you play us a song right now. What have you got prepared for
Well,
us?
The thing is, the 50s music was one of the first songs I learned because it's got that C, E minor, F, G sort of progression.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the first songs I ever learned. And it's not a comedy song, but it's a novelty song. And it's called Teenager in Love.
Each time we have a quarrel, it almost breaks my heart. 'Cause I am so afraid that we will have to part. Each night I ask the stars up above, why must I be a teenager in love?
So me knowing that song kind of led Corky and the Juice Pigs to doing a parody of that, because those songs always like this had like an angel coming down or whatever. So we wrote a song called Don't Put a Pickle, and it goes like this: don't put a pickle on my burger, because it reminds me of my girl. Don't put a pickle on my burger, because if you do, I think I'm gonna hurl. She drove into the she drives into the drive-in basically, and she has an accident and then she dies, so now I can't stand having pickle on my burger. Don't put a pickle on my burger, cause it reminds me of my girl. Don't put a pickle on my burger, cause if you do, I think I'm going to
gorgeous.
You can actually get that if you go on philnickel.com and click on the Cork and the Juice Pigs logo. It'll take you to Cork and the Juice Pigs website. You can hear that on our, I recorded it on a 4-track way back when in 1988.
Oh, 88? 58? Yeah. Something I really enjoy about 1950s music is the playfulness.
Yes.
And the way that they could break out of song and go between different characters.
Yeah.
I think that's shown really nicely in Summertime Blues, Eddie Cochran. I think that was 1958, I think.
Yeah.
So you've got a, well, I'm gonna raise a fuss and I'm gonna raise a holler. About a working all summer just to try to earn a dollar. Well, every time I call my baby trying to get a date, my boss says, no, die, son, you gotta work late. Sometimes I wonder, what am I gonna do? But there ain't no cure for the summertime blues. Yeah. So you've got that one, but there's also Yakety Yak, which is another really, really good example of it, which I think, take out the papers and the trash, or you won't get no spending cash. If you don't scrub that kitchen floor, you ain't gonna rock and roll no more. Yakety yak, don't talk back.
I do like all those funny voices. Like, you got the big bopper. They're going, hello, baby. You know, at the beginning of it, let's go to the hop. Let's go to the hop.
Yeah.
And you've also got all those like spoken word bits. So in the middle of the Juice Pig song there that I sang there, there's big spoken words where they tell you the story of what happened. Like, and that kind of having characters, broad characters in it, it's not purely comedy, but it's pretty funny.
It's fantastic. In Summertime Blues, they go to the United Nations. He said, I'm going to take my problem to the United Nations. Name one other song that talks about the United Nations.
Let's Go to the United Nations by Sally Jess, 1964. And then there was United Nations, Here We Come by Rupert Dingdill, the French singer. And then there was Where Am I Now? United Nations by Wally Scott, who is sadly passed away in New York at the United Nations. So it's time for the comedy song contest, David.
It's the competition, though, isn't it, Phil?
It's a contest, as we all know, David. It's a contest.
It's a competition.
Cool. We've had so many great entries. We've had entries from all over the world, as we said last week. This week's entry submission is by a group called the Midlife Crisis Orchestra, who describe themselves as three Swedish friends making music about the horrible struggles you face as a white, middle-aged, privileged family father. And this track is called Cringe Dad.
I'm follow you when you walk to school, cause I'm the creature. And when you meet your friends, I'm gonna act like a fool, cause I'm the creature. You beg me not to say anything, but I will always say something embarrassing. Cause I'm the creature. Yeah, I'm the creature.
Part two of the Nativity.
Well, song two.
Song two, of course. Song two, yes. So, Phil, what happened last week?
Oh, well, we opened our Nativity with a blinding song with a word out of the piano tuning book, glue. And it was, I think, the angel Gabriel and the host of angels telling Mary that she was preggers with God's glue. It's going to be classy.
Very classy.
Song number two.
obviously, we've got a plot, haven't we, this time?
Well, we've got a plot because we know what happens. He dies in the end.
This is a nativity. He doesn't die yet.
Well, we know how it ends. Yeah, you can really. I think celebrating the whole birth of the guy that you know is going to die young is a little bit sick, to be honest. So Mary has to confess.
Mary does have to confess.
I don't know if confessing is the right word.
Well, she's got to tell some people that she's pregnant.
That's what she did next.
That is what she did next. So she's gonna go and tell her cousin.
Well, flick to the book, the tuning book.
The tuning book. Okay, what have we got?
Finger down, and the word is being.
Being.
Yes.
Okay. Being.
Being.
Right.
Ooh, that's interesting.
Okay.
Being.
All right. Here we go.
Okay. Hey there, Zach and Liz, you are my cousins. Listen to this, I got knocked up by a deity. He called himself God. And as he entered me, I said his name over and over and over again. I knew that God showed his love. And now I'm gonna be the mother of a being. The Lord, he is all seeing. And I know you need to know. Inside me the baby grows, and he's gonna be the king of the Jews. But before that, I want you to choose his name.
Jesus. Jesus.
Really, Zach? If you're funny and you write funny songs, why not enter our Songs in the Key of Laugh comedy song contest? Go to songsinthekeyoflaugh.com for details and send your submissions to songsinthekeyoflaugh@gmail.com. There's a £200 grand prize with two £50 prizes for the runners-up. Do it today!
Interview time.
Interview time.
Interview time.
It was a good one this week.
It was. We had so much fun meeting our next guest.
Yeah. Talented.
Very, very, very talented.
And funny. And nice.
Yeah.
And young. So she's got a career. This is our interview with
Amy
Weber.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The guest on today's show is someone you might know. And if you don't, that's your own fault. But you'll know them soon.
You boy, you will.
This jingle has been personalized for a guest that we hope that you recognize. So. And this week their name is...
Insert name here.
Amy Weber. It's Amy Weber, everybody.
Hi,
Amy Weber.
Hi.
Welcome to our podcast. Now, Amy Weber, well, what do we know about you? You were born in Kent.
Yeah.
You're a musical genius.
Wow.
And that's what we've read.
After 6 years of training, could call it a genius, could say average.
Well, I guess it depends. I love musical bods. I love people that have that... training that I don't have. David's more—he's more the muso guy. So
hi,
yeah. so he'll ask you all those like technical questions.
I won't, but you know, we'll talk about it anyway. But yeah, thank you for joining us on Songs in the Key of Laughs.
Yeah.
So you were recently a finalist for the Musical Comedy Awards as well. Yes.
Right. Okay. So that's the thing. So there's a leap in life logic, and that's, I'm sure there's an interesting story arc on how you've gone through all these different permutations of your skills and talents. How did you end up specifically doing comedy, and at what point did you think actually that's where my place is?
Good question, because it's all really only happened in the last 2 or 3 years. It feels quite recent. So I did a acting course, sort of cringy to admit, like a 4-month training part-time thing, and it culminated in a showcase.
Right.
And the guy who was directing it said, okay, Amy, you're a singer, so when the agents come, you should be showing your singing.
Yeah.
Like, why don't you try and sing a song that has like a bit of opera, a bit of pop, a bit of musical theatre, and preferably 2 minutes long? And I was like, that song doesn't exist. The only song close to it, I don't know if you know it, is Girl in 14G.
Yes.
Mm. Yeah. So that sort of showcases, and it's perfect for someone who can sing opera and jazz and pop and go low and high and has also got a good musical theatre belt. But he was like, it needs to be 2 minutes. And I was like, oh. So I wrote a song. At the time, I had a ukulele, which I bought to help me with my teaching. I used to teach one day a week in a primary school doing musical workshops. Mm-hmm. And so I had this ukulele and I was like, fuck it, I'll just write my own 2-minute song where I go, my name's Amy Weber, I will be a great singer for you. And I sing opera and I sing jazz and then I sing it. Anyway, I performed this song and everyone laughed. And like, obviously it was funny because I was kind of showing off, and I would sing things like, I can sing slowly and beautifully. And it was all just sort of kind of showy offy, but in a silly way. Also a bit sort of taking the piss out for myself.
Yes.
As you have to be if you're ever going to show off. Otherwise, it's just crass and horrible.
Yes.
So I did that song, and then just loads of people came up at the end and was like, you should do that at a comedy night. And I just went along with the ride and thought, hey, stage time is stage time. So I did a couple of gigs. My first one was at Frog and Bucket in Manchester, the Gong Show.
Okay.
And I won it with that song. And then... yeah, it wasn't till about a year later that I threw the ukulele into the cupboard and my new set was born.
Right.
But that is how I initially started comedy, was doing 3 little songs, all about 2 minutes long with a ukulele. And I did a few open spots in Edinburgh, a few open spots in Manchester, and that was like summer 2019.
Mm.
And then through lockdown is when my new I was reborn and I moved to London. And I did try and reinvent myself because I think I was a bit embarrassed of the ukulele beginnings.
The ukulele is an interesting instrument, isn't it? Because anyone that plays a string instrument knows that it just sounds, there's something with the nylon strings, the sound of it just, it sounds cheap, or it sounds, but then, there are people that play, if you've seen the Ukulele Orchestra of Britain, it's phenomenal. And you think, you know, there is a way of making it great.
Yeah.
But the idea of the idea of like a solo female singer with ukulele, I think there's maybe Regina Spektor. There's not that many that have, but she also plays. She's a classically trained musician.
Yeah, she's so, an amazing
musician. So the thing is, for her playing it, it's almost like she knows how dumb that might be. Mm. So maybe there's something in it. But
there is a place for it, though. I think if it's done very, very well. No. But Rialina, for example, when she does it, I did a show with her many years ago that was just which was ukulele based, and she's a very, very good ukulele player.
Yeah,
and she doesn't just go through three chords.
Yeah.
She will make her songs much more complicated and will do full chord sequences. What a lot of the time happens is that people will play the ukulele and they will make their chord sequences very, very simplified.
Yeah.
Sure. So you will only end up with the three chords rather than it being like a 10-chord thing. Whoa.
I think Rialina did say to me recently that she wants to learn to play the guitar, though.
Really?
Because it just is... It's almost to me like the ukulele is like the there are people that must play great recorder. However, playing the recorder is like a cheap version of playing a flute or playing a clarinet or something. It's the same, and it's sort of like a way of beginning.
Yes, so
it's quite nice. Yeah. You've brought that. You know you do play the keyboards, and you do play. Do you play any other instruments?
Keyboards.
Yeah, just keyboards.
And singing.
Yeah, and singing. And do you play guitar or any other?
I did try and learn guitar, but it was so hard. I tried to knock down way harder than the ukulele. But I think my embarrassment was that I was a professional musician. So, you know, if a friend comes to me or I'm working with a kid in a primary school who's like, I can do three chords on ukulele, that's obviously great.
Yes.
And I think instruments like that make music accessible are amazing.
Yes.
But for me, as a graduate, about to start my master's in music, I was just like, "It's actually, I need to branch out."
Okay, so let's go. Yeah. So your master's, because we've had that many classically trained.
Well, we spoke to fascinating idea. Yeah,
so you go from that intense musical. Well, it's a degree, right? So. I'm only assuming without having done it, because I did my degree is in acting, actually. I did 4 years of acting. So, but people don't really, they go, acting? Like, why does it take you 4 years to learn acting?
Yeah,
you go,
same
well, actually, actually, yeah, you could do acting. Anyone can act, really. You just teach yourself to act. But after 4 years, I can't even explain. Another actor would bore you because we'd be sitting there going, yeah, but in the, you know, the Alexander technique, when you're in the supine position, you'd be going, what the f-? But it must be the same musically for you.
Yeah.
You've got that knowledge, and then suddenly you're on stage with a ukulele playing your three chords and singing your daft song.
Five
chords, sorry. but you obviously, you're doing it. And it's fulfilling. Is that for putting the musicality back into? Is that why you decided to adapt to bring the keyboard into the proceedings?
I think good use of word there. Proceedings.
Thanks.
Yeah. I've never referred to my comedy set as proceedings, but it could.
Well, I was thinking more of your creative life.
A creative proceeding.
Well, proceeding. That's how you're going to proceed.
Oh yeah, yeah. clearly I don't know enough words.
I use the word proceeding a lot.
Do you?
Yeah.
Okay, I never
most of
use
my
it.
Conversations proceed with
proceeding.
Anyway.
I think what it was is I suddenly realized the ukulele was going to be limiting.
Right.
So I had, with those three songs, I basically had 10 minutes with a bit of chat in between, and people were talking about, you know, getting your first 20. This is when I wasn't really in the comedy scene. I didn't know what type 5 and 10s and 20s meant. And I just thought, well, I can't just do loads of ukulele songs and have my own show. That was from the start. My aim was, I'm going to have a one-woman show. So I was like, okay, I'm going to need to get something else involved. And at the same time, I started my master's. My master's wasn't in classical opera. It was in pop. So pop singing and writing. And at the same time as me almost exactly at the same time, I got a bad review from Chortle for the World Series finals at Beat the Frog. And it said, you know, woman singing a sweet little song. Actually, he didn't call me a woman. He called me a girl, which is not great because I was
30. Because it's Steve Bennett.
Yeah. Okay. But he also said I had a phenomenal voice, and that quote has remained on my poster. But anyway, I do actually owe him a small thanks. I mean, I should say, don't call me a girl. Don't call any women over the age of 18 a girl. But anyway,
yes, of course.
He said, it's not original. He just said, you know, phenomenal voice, but she's singing a song with a ukulele, and it's been done before. And at almost the same time I read that quote and felt a bit gutted, I had started my master's where my teacher said, can you record yourself singing? And I was like, no. She's like, do you have your own microphone? Do you have an interface? Do you have Ableton or Logic? Mm. No. Mm. And she was like, you need to get it. You can't be an empowered singer if every time you want to record a song, you're relying on your mostly male friends to record it for you, to play the backing track for you, to input the drums for you.
Yeah.
And I was just like, oh. And I was quite a technophobe. And that was the start of it. So I got Ableton. I downloaded it. I had some painstaking hours through lockdown of like crying when, you know, when things go wrong on a computer.
Yeah, yeah.
And just this like loads of imposter syndrome. Possibly because I'd grown up around lots of guys in recording studios and not actually seen many women using music technology. And so I just thought, well, I can't do it. I must be shit at it. I mustn't be able to write a bass line or blah, blah, blah. And so the new act was born. And with the new act, writing songs was like endless. You know, suddenly having enough music for an hour seemed not easy, but achievable compared to the ukulele.
Yeah.
So it went in the cupboard.
I
only use it for teaching. And then you only need three chords for it.
But we've had interviews with all across this series, this podcast. And most of the people that we interview, one of the things that's freed them is their ability to record themselves, which has become really easy in the modern world. It's like, I think 10 years ago, even, it was a much more difficult thing. When I was in my 20s, I had a four track Tascam, and I was just driven to record. I just had the microphones on all the time because I was a weirdo. But that freedom that gives you, and it's interesting that you're saying that because it was a male dominated field. And I've been, on TikTok and watching more and more young female producers, not just songwriters, producers, giving tips. It's a real burgeoning field of like, this is going to change the pop music scene. And then being able to do stuff yourself is, I mean, Dave has got a great setup because he's a proper musician with band and band leader. But that ability to write, that means that you're going to be able, when you say that you're, you know, you've got enough for an hour. We just interviewed Johnny the Baptist for something, and you know, they've got how many albums? 9 albums now in like 10 years.
Crazy,
because and they feel like the kind of guys that just keep coming up. They just are unstoppable. They just because once you can record it, once you can do that, the world is your oyster. So
what's your process? I'm quite intrigued by this. So knowing that you've now got this kind of new set of skills, which I'm sure that you're still playing around with a lot of the time. I still am. I've had Logic for years and years, but I'm still like, oh, there's a new button, and then you work out what that one does. But so what's your process, and where do you link in your phenomenal voice with what you're doing on is it Logic that you're using or Ableton?
So I write in Logic,
okay,
and then I export it. And I put all the samples and sounds and songs and tracks into Ableton, which I then use to perform live.
Cool.
So I use both.
Amazing.
Which is helpful.
Yes.
So I always start with the lyrics. So it's like, funny concept. What's someone who, a group of people who are kind of funny, or like the song I'm going to perform for you later live is taking the piss out of sort of music producers,
right?
Sort of wanky ones, you know, who really love their own music and take it really seriously. That always makes me laugh about music. Same with opera. Mm-hmm. Music's meant to be fun and it's meant to release emotion. I guess sometimes it can be sad, but when people take music really seriously, it just makes me cringe a bit. So I write funny lyrics, I try and make them rhyme, I try and write a chorus. That's the hard bit for me. And then, or the less enjoyable bit, and it's sort of rhyming things and going, are these lyrics too obvious? Are they a bit cheesy? Are they a bit? And I'll always run them past my sister, who has nothing to do with comedy or performing.
Right.
She like works in the Royal Parks and she loves bugs and stuff.
She loves
and
bugs.
She's so honest. So she'll just be like, that's good. Or she's like, an awful idea. And I just I just go, okay, fair. Yeah, that's going in the bin. Scrunch it up on the laptop. And
but that does make sense, though, because that is like our core audiences as comedy performers. We tend to play to punters, to people that they're just going to see a comedy night. They're not necessarily, I mean, hopefully you get to a point where they're coming to see you specifically. Mm. But that changes things. When it's just, when you just have to impress, you've got 20 minutes to impress a group of people that have never met you before. Your sister is probably a pretty good sounding board on what will be acceptable to them or not, if she likes bugs. So actually.
Yeah.
A lot of people out there like bugs.
And moths, I should say.
Okay.
I mean, also then, if she really likes butterflies and bugs, then it's quite a low bar. So...
Oh, hang on a minute. I hope your sister doesn't listen to this.
In the entertainment world.
Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know what the ants are up to at the moment, but I don't know. Are they doing big circus tours?
Well, if you take a look at their society, it's very intelligent. I can imagine.
I saw a thing about the ants where they poured concrete into an ant, a large ant colony.
Oh,
and then,
no.
And then, no, this is to they flushed them out, but then they flushed them all out. It's a friendly project, and they pour the concrete in, and then dug out the concrete to show you the labyrinth, and it's unbelievable what the amount like ants to the equivalent. They're saying the ants carry the dirt from the bottom out to the surface and put on the outside. It would be the equivalent of a male human being carrying like a 600-pound load 3 kilometers. And then going back down and doing it again for about 3 years every day.
And then they die.
And then, well, and then, yeah, exactly. They're serving the queen.
Unless you're lucky enough to get the one person who gets with the queen.
Yeah, exactly.
Might be worth carrying all that rubble.
Yeah.
Well, they do, yeah.
Is that how it works? So they all just try to impress her? I don't think that's
just,
they're
trying to
keep her.
Sister.
They're just trying to keep her safe.
So yeah, that's it. Ants. It's just their instinct.
Yeah. Really?
No, bad instinct. I just never thought about it. I've got that. Imagine being like an anti. Imagine being anti-royalist and an anyway. So your sister,
anti-royalist.
Thanks. Anyway, it's a bad joke, but I said it.
Can we go back to the process?
I want to go back to the process, but I want to make sure we're still following this. I want to follow this art.
Oh no, yeah, in the timeline.
There's a leap from this where we've got to the you're in the contest and then Steve Bennett. And it's funny how a bad review can actually inspire you. I used to have a small black book when I was a teenager because I had a lot of teachers that hated me because I just wanted to be an actor, so I was an asshole. Mm. But anyone that did me wrong, their name went in the black book, and it kind of it had the other effect on me. It made me think, I have to be better. I can't be criticized this way anymore. I must be. I'm going to do it. And because you know you can, because you knew he sees, all he's seeing is that one thing of you playing the ukulele, but you know in your mind, wait a minute, I'm way more than that.
Yeah.
And I'm going to show you. So you take that on. Anyway, back to the process. I just want to make sure we're following.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've got my arc.
Yeah, you got your arc. I'm going to
do your arc.
I'll do mine. Okay. Yeah. How do we, so you said that you, you put your ideas past your sister, but when you're actually sitting down and writing, you said that the lyrics come first.
Yeah.
What do you then throw underneath those lyrics, and how do you come around with that? How long have you played the piano, for example, for as well?
So piano I've played for quite a few years, maybe since I was a teen, but just chords. And it wasn't really till uni that I even knew what like inversions were. So it was very basic piano, and it's still quite basic. Lots of block chords. I'm not particularly good. If someone says do like 1-4-5-1 -6-2 7-1 in D flat major, it might take me sort of 5 minutes to work out.
Yeah.
Right.
Whereas before, So you get the sort of standard of piano, and I have done original music while playing the piano. But again, it's quite like simple parts. I'm not doing really crazy stuff. So I start with. I normally have a little idea for a chorus, so I'll just sing it completely a cappella and save it into my phone, into the mic, as everyone does. So I'll like come up with a little chorus and sort of be like, something like that.
Yeah.
Then I'll take that and I'll come to the song in Logic, and I normally start with chord progression to the right tempo. Then I'll add the drums. And so I might listen to some pop songs and like get some inspiration of like a certain beat or certain types of sounds of the drum. Mm. Then I'd put that in with the chords. So that's like the skeleton of my piece will be the song in the right structure with the right chord progression with the drums. Then I'll put a bass line in. I'll delete the chord, the like basic piano chords that are in there. And then obviously replace them with like synths and other sounds. And then that's when the fun bit begins for me. That's like kind of like you're painting a picture and you've done it in pencil.
Yes.
And then when I get to put all the synths on and pan things to the left and right and turn up gain and effects and stuff like that, that's when it's like painting it with colour.
Yeah.
And then the final bit is obviously recording the vocals and then the harmonies. And I love doing that bit.
Yeah.
So that's the fun bit.
That's your thing though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that bit doesn't feel hard and it doesn't feel like, oh, what if I get this wrong? Sometimes still with the drums and the bass, I'll put something in and I'm like, maybe this is a drum beat that drummers wouldn't use or a bass line that's too hard to play and so a bit unrealistic. But a lot of drummers and bassists have said to me, just fuck that. Just put in what you want. If it sounds good, don't worry about it. But the singing bit and adding the harmonies is like, yeah, something I feel really confidently with. Confident. And then I release it and then everyone says, well, not everyone, normally people say, oh my god, that was so catchy, it was really annoying, I had it stuck in my head for days.
That's great.
And that's what I'd like to be my what I get known for is writing catchy music that sticks in your head.
Yeah. And the thing is, the nice thing about doing comedy songs is that you can write these really melodic and complex melodies, but you're not taking yourself too seriously. But you could actually just replace those lyrics with some kind of really heartfelt, deep thing, and those tunes would be the same.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of actually one of the songwriters I've always admired is Betty Boo, who's written all these really famous. But she's started off doing like novelty stuff. Do you know what I mean? She's probably the same. And she knew she's capable of writing these great melodies and this complex stuff, but didn't want to take it too seriously at first.
Yeah.
And I think my favorite musicians are people that don't take too seriously. Like, I think that's why the Beatles were successful.
Yeah.
And why I like the Beatles more than the Rolling Stones. Because
or like Queen.
Yeah. Queen had lots.
You know, the lyrical content of some of their songs is so silly.
Exactly.
It's really bicycle. Fun.
Yeah.
I mean, what is that?
They were just literally having a laugh, I think.
Brilliant. They were.
Yeah.
There's a great clip online right now of Freddie Mercury, and they're doing the Live Off the Floor track, and he's making fun of them, saying he's just changing the lyrics slightly, going, what is this? I wish I could remember exactly. One turd, that's it, one turd, yeah. And
I
it's just, yeah, and it's just really...
Turd is a strong word.
It's really strong.
It's just really nice to see that, like...
Just called you a turd.
Yeah.
It was more sort of abstract than that.
I don't think it was. I think you actually just pointed and you went, I just called you a turd as well. You're a turd.
Yeah.
Right, thanks for that. But she
nailed it.
She's
only just met you.
Well, you too are a turd. Congratulations.
Thank you.
But we just went into musical influences there slightly. Yeah. Have you got any musical influences that are really influenced
you? What did you listen to in the past and what are you listening to right now?
So when I was growing up, I listened to a lot of Ella Fitzgerald.
Yeah.
And then I would listen to quite a lot of like 90s sort of hip hop. So like Tupac or... Rocky or...
Tribe Called Quest.
Fugees.
Mm. Yeah, Fugees.
So it was like a lot of jazz and hip-hop, which is sort of weird. And then I studied opera, didn't listen to opera. I actually don't really like listening to it. I just like singing it. Mm. And now I listen to quite a mix of stuff now. Some really fun indie pop. I went to see James Taylor last night. I love Steely Dan.
Well,
I love Dave, the rapper, Stormzy.
Right. So eclectic, basically.
Yeah.
Like across the board.
Yeah.
That's very much similar taste, but I mean, I like all those, the artists we're talking about, but I like being able to listen to, you know, like a bit of hip hop and then, you know, go. Ella Fitzgerald is great. But and going back to the thing about funny lyrics is all those old school jazz musicians, all those Cole Porter songs are all humorous.
Yeah.
And classically.
Yeah, and they don't take themselves seriously.
And lyrically. Yeah, and the whole thing is, you know, Louis Jordan wrote comedy songs, you know, open the door, Richard, open the door and let me in, from the point of view of a drunk guy that can't find his keys. And hip hop has it as well. Hip hop has there's a comp, like especially 90s hip hop, where like from Run DMC on, people, they didn't take it quite as seriously as gangster rap or Kanye. Mm. Don't imagine Kanye writing a funny song.
No.
No.
I mean, could he? What would Kanye's funny song be? If he was to write one,
he just wouldn't.
No, he
just got too much of an ego to do something
funny.
Yeah, because he wants to be perceived in a certain way, and I think being funny is quite disarming.
Yeah,
can be kind of vulnerable, and I don't think he wants to be perceived.
But he's
like
missing
that.
A trick, because if you're going to be the Messiah, I think you have to have a sense of humor.
Did the Messiah have a sense of humor?
I bet he did. I bet he played dead all the time. And just joking. You can't kill me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, yeah.
Well, the disciples, they do a pylon and Jesus at the bottom. Then they go, they all get up like, oh my God, we've killed him. And then he goes, bah, just kidding.
Yeah. Buys no evidence one. Of that, but it could well be true.
No, yeah, but no evidence. No, there's no, you're correct. No, there's no evidence of the Lord.
Yeah. Playing pranks.
What?
We're not going to go into a conversation about whether or
I'm
not
just joking.
Whether or not God is real.
Well, I'm just talking about the pylon Jesus. There's
pylon.
No, and I think Amy's correct. There is no evidence that the disciples ever did a pylon. Although, if you know disciples, the
I
way
know.
I do.
They had those big drunken dinners.
You tickly. You tickled the Christ.
Tickly.
You would, you would have tickled the Christ.
Silly.
Of course you would have tickled the Christ. He's just walked on water. You would have tickled the Christ. We're moving on.
Like
sorry.
Innuendo.
I think it's interesting that you're even in musical influences that there's still that through line of a lot of the things you mentioned there about lyrics, lyrically.
Yeah.
So it's you didn't go, I'm into techno, although you probably do like a bit of techno at the right time and place,
it's probably
right?
Probably my least favorite genre, actually, techno.
Yeah.
Because it's quite repetitive.
Mm.
And with the lack of singing or lyrics, I also find there's a lack of like rhythmic variation.
Yeah.
Professional techno.
No, it is more about
writer would be angry at that, but
no, I think to people that are into techno understand it's a taste thing.
Feels like you have to go into a meditation to sort of enjoy it.
Yeah. Or be really high on some,
yeah, exactly. I don't do drugs, so yeah.
I recently went to Bestival and nice. It's the first time that we've taken our 6 month or 7 month old child to a festival, and she
headphones.
yeah all of the headphones and all of that. Oh, but went to see Fatboy Slim. Fatboy Slim, he's great.
Yeah.
Okay, and I must have seen him at festivals maybe 10, 15 times.
Yeah.
But those other times, maybe I wasn't as sound of mind. watching it with my child, who was sleeping.
Substances in your blood.
I've never touched things ever obviously. But watching these massive visuals that he's got going on with this pumping music, I was much less impressed than I thought I would be. Then I went round the corner and who was playing to like three or four people but Punjabi MC. Oh my goodness, he's incredible. So we just ended up jumping around to that instead.
Yeah.
But it is a complete taste thing, and you have to be in the right right headspace to enjoy that sort of music, I think. So that's
it's not for me.
No, fair enough. Yeah. But you said that opera's not for you either. So how long did you study opera for?
Well, 4 years.
4 years,
and
okay.
Before going to uni, you know, it was my hobby. So I had lessons every Tuesday night with my singing teacher, and I'd do competitions. I'd like apply and do workshops at weekends. And so singing opera was quite a big part of my life.
Did you ever perform as part of a full opera, as in, and the acting side of things as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So before going to uni, I did, there's a company based in Oxford called Opera Anywhere, who literally do operas all over the country. You know, we'd do operas on a boat, we've sung operas on punts, we've sung operas in a farm.
They would do it anywhere.
Yeah, literally anywhere. It's quite cool. Hence the name.
Yes.
I sung a few roles for them.
Okay.
So I started when I was younger as like the little parts, and then obviously by the time I was 18 and about to go to uni, I was singing the lead soprano parts. And then when I got to uni, I'd be in the chorus. So every year we do two operas in our opera theatre at college. Royal Northern College of Music has an amazing opera department, big stage, you know, full front of house, back of house team. So it feels like you're in a professional production. Mm-hmm. They try and make it as professional as possible. Well, they sell tickets, so it has to be to the public. It has to be professional. Mm. And then by the time I was leaving in fourth year, I did an opera where I was one of the lead parts. That was actually a really dark opera. It was called Anya 17. It was by Adam Gorb. And so it was a modern opera, contemporary, amazing music though. And it was about sex trafficking. So it was about some people who had been trafficked to England. And my character was blind and had lost her son. And so it was a very different type of performance. You know, it was so guttural. And I almost made myself cry singing the aria I had to sing.
Wow.
And you could see the audience sort of sobbing, which was good, but strange. So I really loved when opera combined the acting, whether that was fun operas like Scene in Carmen, where I was in the chorus, or being a naughty child in the La Boheme Kids Chorus, or this opera where I was being trafficked. That's a really fun part of opera, when the drama meets the singing.
Yeah.
And suddenly it's not even about the singing, and all the 4 years of training of, you know, trying to control, like you were talking about, how complex studying acting can be for 4 years. It was the same with singing, you know, when you're singing a certain vowel, is your jaw going... Does it need to move by 1 millimeter? Does your tongue need to move by 2 millimeters? Are you not lifting your soft palate enough? There's so much conceptual stuff that happens inside that you don't even know as well. It's like, think higher. What are you actually changing? You're not sure. But so all that training goes to the side, and it's like, now you're on stage, you have to act. You have to be the character and hope that your muscle memory kicks in and you know how to sing well.
Yes.
So I did really enjoy that part of it. But there was a lot of work. So after you leave uni, there was a lot of work to continue doing opera full time, a lot of auditions, a lot of trying to get an agent. And from what I could see, the next 6 years for me at least were going to be being in the chorus. And I didn't want to be in the chorus. I wanted to be the lead part. Yeah. And also opera was getting increasingly, as I grew up and grew older and was getting more involved in politics, in a loose sense, politics as in realizing that, you know, feminism is still important, or realizing that as a white person I've had a very different experience to some of my colleagues at uni who were people of color, that kind of politics, as well as politics, and opera seemed to be very bare on sort of liberalism and diversity, and realizing that in its very essence the classical music world is so elitist, and it's not really developing, it's not coming forward with the times. You know, every now and then there'll be a new opera at the Royal Opera House, but it's still, when they look at the ticket sales, it's still not, they're not really modernising fast enough.
No.
And so I was like, I don't know if this is an industry I really want to be in. Maybe I'll switch to pop.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what I did after a few years, because opera just, if I couldn't be the lead part, I didn't want to do it.
There's a lot of comedians out that come from the acting world who I think feel the same. You're the lead character in the thing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I started off doing before I started doing the comedy stuff. I was in like an actor's apprentice in the Canadian version of Regent's Park, and I had like two tiny roles in it. But I'd come from the university where my fourth year I was the lead role, and it suddenly felt like going back to high school, and you're suddenly not the big kid anymore. And I think being on stage and being the main guy is part of the fun of it.
Yeah.
But it's also very like you are alone up there, so you've got to, you know, there's no one else to rely on. So that's, I think that's part of the fun of it.
It's why I like to be a musical director, because I get to sit just away from everything and still take loads of accolades.
Yeah.
Because the music was absolutely wonderful. Done, absolutely. But, you know, I've been in plays and things, and I did an A-level and in drama, but I don't like learning lines, so I never really did.
Not
and
for you then. Sorry, I just burped. You might want to...
That's okay. Yeah, I want to just get some wipes
it
out.
It was quite quiet. Yeah. I don't know if
I didn't hear it, okay. But...
It was more of like
you swallowed it.
Yeah.
Oh, well done.
Yeah.
I just had an idea, and I want to just say it into the mic before we get, but how about ukulele, the opera? You know, like an opera about ukuleles, just all opera singers.
Yeah.
No, there must be someone that invented a ukulele. We could write an opera about them. Anyway, it's my idea. You're not having it.
I tell you what, though, I did.
All right, Amy.
I could be in it, though.
You could be. That's a ukulele opera. The woman that invents the ukulele.
I recently went on tour in to Germany, and while we were in Germany, we went to the city where harmonicas were made.
Oh, right.
Right? Aww. And the purse... And so we went to this tour around the Harmonica Museum and saw harmonicas that Stevie Wonder had used, that Bob Dylan had used. It was amazing. Wow. And they had accordions. They had... for me, I was like, wow, this is just the best place ever.
Yeah.
But at the end of this tour, a gentleman gave us his CD, and there was an opera made about harmonicas. So they have made
a
operas.
Whole opera, or you mean
well,
a song?
If I'm completely honest, I haven't listened to the whole thing.
Okay,
but no, it's a whole
opera.
It was a full opera about the town where the harmonicas were made, with obviously the harmonicas being the main industry there. So So that's the Horner.
So
musical.
What you're saying, you're just giving me fuel for thought.
I am. Could work.
In fact, I can't stop thinking about it now, guys.
Ukulele.
Just
the opera.
An opera.
Yeah.
But you'll get the ukuleles. It's not going to happen. But
it's not, no. But
yeah. So what was the... You mentioned your first comedy song was this bit that you wrote, Out of Necessity.
2 minute song.
Yeah. And then you thought, I need to write... I can't... I'm going to try and write an hour, and it can't all be ukulele.
Mm.
What was the turning point when you put the ukulele away? Do you play the ukulele at all in your new show?
No.
No. In your hour show, do you play it?
No.
Would you like to be in an opera about ukuleles?
No.
So, okay. I feel what we only place we can go now is we need to go back. So, because I'm kind of mesmerized. I'll be perfectly honest with you. Because you said you've studied writing pop music, which must be great for your comedy songwriting.
Yeah.
But you're a trained opera singer.
Yeah.
And that's obviously, so your understanding of that, I mean, to me, I can't get my, I'm not a huge fan of opera. Obviously, I've seen a few. When they're performed by the top level professionals, like anything, like ballet, anything, it's spellbinding. But when it's performed by people that are sort of learning the craft or working on the craft, you can just go, oh, God, please stop singing. And then every once in a while, you'll see someone, like we were in Hungary in Budapest recently, there was an opera singer in a park, and she was phenomenal. Mm-hmm. And we were just like, wow, like... I'm just rambling.
Stop. I'm going to go back.
I was really happy earlier, guys. I just rambled.
I'd like to go back to you've gone from opera to pop.
Yeah.
Okay, but you write the comedy stuff, but you also still write pop songs as well. I've heard quite a few of your non-comedy stuff as well, and it's amazing. You've got such a wonderful tone to your voice,
and the
songwriting is. I heard an interview that you did where somebody had described one of the songs that you've done as sounding a bit like a song by Adele.
Yes.
Of which you at first were, I'm going to take a bit of offence to that. Mm. But then you realised, wait a minute.
That's a compliment.
That 100%. Yeah. So
they said it like it was a bad thing. They were like, oh, it's a bit... it's a bit generic. It sort of sounds like Adele. And I was like, oh, right, yeah, that's generic. That must be bad. Because music always needs to be new and different. And then I was like, hang on a minute. Yeah. It's already new and different because it's my voice.
Yeah.
Anyway.
But pop, it's in the, but pop is means popular. It's pop, like the king of pop. The king, you know, the Michael Jackson, all these things that are where everyone in the world knows the song, knows the track, is what you're aiming for when you're writing a pop song. And I know as a songwriter, it's when I was younger, I was into punk rock music and stuff, and I used to hate pop music. I hate pop music. It's just terrible. Like, it's just this crap because it's really
mainstream.
It's mainstream, and it's got the production sounds you're like, and it's just obvious and it's just easy. And then, but, and then try and write one, and then you just realize it's not that easy.
Do you do those gigs as well? So as well as your comedy, so have you got an hour show at the moment?
Yes.
So you've got an hour show at the moment, but do you also do your straight stuff as well?
My straight music. So my straight music, I've got 45-minute set, but the last gig I did was last summer. So it was over a year ago, and I just haven't been pushing it. When I moved to London, I was sort of like, okay, I'm going to try and do comedy. I'm going to get a new band for my original music and try and push that. And I'm going to push being a function singer, which I also do as part of my job. So obviously function singing is, well, you know what that is, singing at events and bars and weddings. Yeah. But then when I got to London, I was like, oh, there is so many gigs and so much networking I have to do in the comedy world. And it was kind of like a bit exhausting trying to split my time between being serious singer, function singer, who's always trying to improve, and comedian. And so a few friends and my boyfriend was like, why don't you just focus on one for like a year or even 2 years and stop spreading yourself so thin? And it was good advice. So I've really ditched the original music, which is a shame. I still write songs sometimes, but I've not been releasing them. I've not been like rehearsing them with a band or recording them or performing. And maybe they'll come back. I'd love to release... One of my dreams for life is to release an album, not a comedy album, a straight music album, and obviously do my hour at Edinburgh Fringe. Those are like two sort of dreams I have that maybe I'll be able to do in the next 10 years or something.
Yeah.
So I still like writing, but it's difficult, you know, when like this afternoon, I've got this afternoon off. So I thought, okay, I'll try and write something. And it's like, am I going to write a serious song or a comedy song? And when I look at my Instagram and what I'm trying to push and really what I want to get more jobs from in the next few years, it is comedy. So I think sometimes I'm a bit like, oh well, I won't do that 4-part James Taylor cover I was thinking of.
Right.
I'll just try and write another comedy song, put up a reel, try and get some more followers, try and get some more respect in the comedy world in the hope of getting more gigs.
Yeah.
It is, it's a different world now though, isn't it? So you just mentioned about social media. How important is your social media presence when you're trying to find your way as a comedian and as a newer comedian?
Yeah, I think it's important. I mean, the first thing is if you have lots of followers, it helps you get gigs.
Yeah, it sure does.
That's a really, I mean, I'm not big enough yet, but I think if you get to 20,000, 10,000 followers, bookers will be like, oh, okay, she's got some kind of mass appeal.
Yes.
Obviously, in reality, sometimes people have loads of followers online, but live, their stuff's kind of different. And really, they're good at doing character sketch in their room for 60 seconds, not 20 minutes of stand-up. They are, you know, different skills.
Yeah.
But how it's viewed is, yeah, you've got more accolades if you've got more followers. So it's that. And it's also like putting the feelers out because you can connect with people who you might never meet, but then they might come to a show because they've seen your reels. Mm. And I have seen that happen with people. Mm-hmm. And it actually happened to me in last year. There was someone at my show and I said, how did you hear about it? You know, when I do my one woman show, I've done 6 performances of it ever, last summer 3 and this summer 3. And when I see a face I don't know, I'm really intrigued. I'm like, well, how did you know about this? And you've decided to spend £7 based on a face of my face on a poster and take a risk that it's going to be funny and entertaining. Because I wouldn't. I don't think my sister, again, as a non-performer, would see a poster and go and see someone. But then, of course, what has happened is they've seen me online, then seen my poster.
Yeah.
And that's why they come. And it's happened a few times. I know some comedy colleagues who it's happened to quite a lot, who have got really big on TikTok, and then people, you know, make the effort to travel halfway across London to see them live. So I think it's important, and it also makes you churn out content, which can only be a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, it keeps me writing.
You have to keep writing, yeah.
The videos are a bit frustrating because my videos are quite basic, and I see people with this whole team of videographers and editors and sort of say, oh, what did you pay for that? No, they're just my mates. And I was like, oh, you've got mates who make videos for you on
and
a
they're,
Sunday.
And they're doing the same thing. They're making those videos because they're trying to get their own content and the experience, and they realize you just have to churn stuff out, and it's good for them to do. Although I will say in the TikTok world, the clips that work the best are the ones that look like they've just whipped them together, even though we know there's a bit more artistry behind it.
Yeah, you're right. When you get TikTok, good at it, they like self-made, homemade stuff.
Yeah, they don't like a lot of high edit, like MTV level video. They just don't watch them.
Yeah.
And they're too long.
Yeah.
Whereas if it's you singing the verse and a chorus of a song by yourself, like with a beautiful backdrop, on a lake or something, that's more likely to get hits.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's also changing what people expect from videos and from even from production. Sometimes just one person with a guitar that you get. I've noticed a lot of reels recently that say a voice message. Have you seen that on Apple Music? I've been following a lot of younger musicians, and they on all the albums they've just got a track. It'll just be voice message, and they'll just it's just what they've recorded in their phone.
Yeah.
And it's a really lo-fi. It's more lo-fi than anything else you can do. But because the mics are so good in phones now, you can't if you get the balance right, you can sound just as good on the phone. So. That also makes things more immediate, and I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing. As an old guy, I liked albums and I liked concepts, and that seems to have disappeared. But it's not immediate. We want you do one, you have to have another one ready to go.
Mm.
Like so, you can't. So people don't put an album, but they'll record six songs, but then they're going to put them out every few months, and they call it waterfalling.
Yeah.
Have you seen that? So we're called a waterfalling where they release their thing on Spotify, and then 2 weeks later you release the next one.
Yeah.
But you put that one above it, and you call it it's the same track, so that you end up having this waterfall. And I just find all that stuff really interesting, and it's hard to get my head around. I don't know how old you are, but you're much younger than me. I'm finding it hard to adapt into that world as a comedian.
Do you think it might stop people going to gigs? Like earlier on we were talking about the audience that would go to opera or something. That's the type of audience that's probably going to go online, look what opera is on, and they're like, oh yes, I'm definitely going to go and see Carmen, it's going to be absolutely splendid, lovely, and they will buy a ticket and they will go and sit down and see that show. If somebody sees your reels online and you're trying to sell out the Pleasance on a Thursday night, and or your only thing that you're sending out is on Instagram and on these reels, is that going to transform into selling tickets? I guess it does.
The percentage is quite small.
Yeah.
I think the biggest way right now that I sell tickets is obviously first and foremost is people I know.
Yeah.
And then them telling people they know.
Yeah.
The second is people who've seen me at other gigs coming to another gig. So people seeing me do a 5 or a 7 or a 10 and then following me and then realizing, oh, at this night I'm doing a 20, and then they'll come. And I think then the third is people off you know, online. But say I have 1,000 followers at the moment, I think it's happened to me maybe 3 times that someone's come to a gig because they followed me first.
Okay.
So that's 3 out of 1,000.
Yeah, they say there's something like it. I mean, these are
not lots.
There's like a 10%. Like that's a fairly basic 10% return.
Yeah, but who are actually engaging and watching your stuff. Yeah,
you need that level of recognition.
Yeah.
So what's next for you then? You've done an Edinburgh show. You did an Edinburgh show this year.
No. So this year I went up and did some open spots.
Did you? Okay.
So I did I did about 8 gigs across 5 days.
Okay.
Which was good for me. Next year I really want to go for the full month.
Yeah.
Although it seems quite exhausting.
It is.
terrifyingly expensive
and exhausting. Yeah,
I mean the expensive. I'm less worried about that. I mean, for me, if I go to bed past midnight 2 or 3 days in a row, the first thing it will affect is my voice.
Your voice.
And if you add drink to that,
yep.
If you add talking in noisy environments,
yep. So you'll have to be really.
Yeah. I mean, yeah,
you'll have to be really strict with yourself.
I'll have to be really strict, and at the expense of potentially networking. That's the really hard thing. And I found that this year, I was there for 5 days. You know, people came out at midnight, and I was like, oh, I should really go to bed. But then so and so's over there. I haven't really sort of wanted to chat to them. I wanted to make friends with them. It's not exactly some of it was networking, but some of it was just trying to make friends with people.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, there's. I actually got some quite good advice when I was there from a guy who was a relatively high up TV producer, a very high up TV producer actually, but he didn't really know who I was. He just was introduced to me.
Yep.
And then he said, can I give you some advice? And I was like, okay. I didn't ask for it, but I won it. Okay. So yeah, go on.
Yeah.
And he said, you need to find your year group. So he said, find the people who are at the same level as you now, as in, they're doing the same kind of gigs.
Yeah.
Because I think what he saw when I was there is I was hanging out with people who were getting like nominations and people who've been there for 4 years doing their 1 hour show.
Yeah.
And people who ultimately can't give me much. It's kind of like if I was hanging out with Adele, maybe mm-hmm. not, because I guess she could give me a leg up, but it's, he did have quite a good point. About finding people at a similar level to you, so that next year, if I do go to Edinburgh and it's my first year, I've got a cohort of friends around me who it's also their first year.
Yeah, having the same experience.
And having the same experience. Mm. And so with that in mind, he was like, even if you've got a 1 hour, it still might be good to do a split half hour, do a free fringe, do it with a buddy. Then, you know, the year after, try do 45 minutes free fringe. Year after, maybe 45 minutes paid fringe. Year after, maybe that's your debut year and you do your hour. And it's so I don't know. That is an aim for me. But it's a bit frustrating because I've already got an hour show and I'm quite happy with it now.
Yeah.
I'm sure it could improve if you spoke to a director or something. But I really love performing it and I'm not really ready to, like, put it in the bin. But
I think you should follow your heart on that one, to be honest. Mm. Because if you do your hour thinking, I'm only doing this hour to try and win the newcomer a nomination. So what a shit reason to be doing an hour of comedy. You should be doing an hour of comedy because it's the hour that you've written that you want to do. And then it won't matter because someone, you don't notice, you won't know who's noticing you, and you don't always know who's recognizing you. So even that this our podcast is a tiny little thing, it's you've come through us because someone noticed you and thought, this is an interesting person, let's get it. So all those things will happen for you, and I think that you should follow your heart on that one and not get beaten into a particular method.
It's just the thought of flyering on my own and performing it to one person or none.
Yeah.
It's quite sad.
Sure.
And the thought of having someone with me who I get on with, who I also find funny.
Sure.
And then having one person is sort of like, that would just be like, welcome to Edinburgh.
Yeah.
This is shit, but funny. Whereas doing it on your own. And I've always been a bit of a lone person because I've always done things slightly different. You know, like when I did opera, a lot of people were either going to quit opera as soon as we finished our degree or were going to fully follow it. And I was just this sort of like, oh, I think I want to do pop. And then when I started pop, I was always the pop singer who used to do opera. And so now as a comedian, I still feel like an outsider because really when people ask what I do, my first answer is I'm a musician.
Yes.
And a songwriter. But, you know, so I feel like if I go to Edinburgh on my own, that's so me. I'm just going to be like, I'm a Lone Ranger. I'm doing it my way. And one day all this self-belief will fucking pay off and I will be noticed.
Damn right.
But that imposter...
But I'm still a bit scared of going on my own.
But you have to do the show where there is one person there. You have to do the show where there isn't... We took a show to the States. We did quite well in Florida. We took it up to New York. The producer hadn't done the work. I walked out on stage on the first night. There was not a single person...
Not a single person there. So we had to fly our producer over from here to fill the venue for the next couple. It was horrendous. I was so angry.
Yeah.
But if I hadn't had that moment, and if I hadn't died on stage a couple of times, then how do you know what it feels like to have the thing that you never, ever want to happen again happen? Does that make sense?
Yeah. So you had support then. So your answer was, shit, what do we do? Let's get the producer. See, if that happens to me and there's no one in the audience, zero, sort of nothing I can do.
You go to the loft bar, or you end up in one of the performers' bars talking to this another person. Went, I had two.
Yeah.
That's going to happen. This thing's going to happen. And even when you do loads of them, I have Edinburgh, so I've won awards, and I've had sellout shows, and I've had great five-star shows, and I've also still the odd time you just get a show where you're just going, what, there's no one's interested. Why am I doing this? And I think that imposter syndrome never goes away. And I think if you're healthy, that never goes away. I think you should always feel a bit like that. I bet even Elton John at moments just goes, how did I get away with all that?
Yeah, yeah.
How did I get away with it all? Because I was just this kid from that thing,
yeah.
You know? So I think that's a healthy attitude to have. As far as being alone in Edinburgh, I'm rambling again, but when the bigger the crowds, if you're at a festival, Glastonbury, whatever, that's when I feel my most lonely, and I feel my most together when I'm alone. So it might not be a bad thing for you to do to put yourself through. It's like training. As long as you've done the training and the work and the writing leading up to it, and the rehearsals, or maybe work with a friend that directs or at least gives you feedback, or even if it's your sister, anyone,
then you know
you've done all that training for it. Like, you wouldn't just go and run a marathon, you'd do the training for it.
Yeah, yeah.
So similarly, if you're thinking of next year, you're starting now thinking about what you need to do to get yourself in shape for that. And that means also being prepared for the shit review from Steve Bennett. It'll be one person to Steve Bennett, and you'll be like, oh, well, fucking great, right? When you'll go, no, ukulele.
Yeah.
This is ukulele the opera. I'll be next door doing ukulele opera.
Yeah. Sell out.
Yes.
Sell out.
Yeah, you're not in it. You're not in it. Anyway, I think you should follow your heart on that one.
It's exciting.
It's great.
I remember going to my first Edinburgh and just buzzing my face off, going, this is going to be the greatest thing ever. And then going up and going, this is absolutely terrifying.
Exhausting. Mm.
But then a few years later, you're going up and you've got a five-star show.
Yeah.
And then you're getting asked to go around the world and do these things elsewhere. It's amazing. Yeah. It's phenomenal. So I'm just really excited for you, to be honest.
And I think just from this little chat, then you know, without knowing the depth of your work, that you've got the chops anyway, so it's all just part of a process if you're doing that.
Well, I think I'm quite realistic.
Yeah,
I'm obviously good at songwriting to an extent, because that's what I've trained in.
Yeah,
I do think I'm funny.
Yeah,
it's a good start.
Think well, I you are. Funny.
Well, then you are.
Whether I'm funny on stage is different.
You know, there's that.
I do think I'm funny.
We're having a conversation with a comedian recently about young British artists, the contemporary conceptual artists who like put a piece of blue tack on the wall and call it art. And I defend it. Go, well, it is then, because they're artists. You know, that's Mike Wilmot. That's Mike Wilmot put a Pringles can on the wall and called it art. But he went to art school, and I went, then it is, Mike. And he disagreed with me. But I think comedy is similar. If you think you're funny, you're funny. And there's so many comedians that will tell you that they go nowhere for a long time. And I think of like the anti-comedy, like Mark Silcox or Ed Axel, people that just work away, slowly work away at their thing when everyone's telling them they're not funny. And then suddenly there you realize, oh, no, they're actually the funniest people in the world because they believe they are. And that's it.
Yeah.
So comedy is like that.
It takes patience, doesn't it?
Yeah.
That's what I'm not very good at. I think because I've studied so much, or maybe because of my age, I don't know. I always feel like I should be further along in my career than I am.
Everybody feels that way all
you're
the time.
In a career.
I talk to a lot of friends about that. Yeah, we all feel it.
Imposter syndrome is the most horrendous thing ever, but it eats you as well. Every single night when if I'm on stage, I go out and I'm like, what am I doing? Also, right now, I'm playing in the Amy Winehouse band. So it's her original band with a different singer and me on keys. I didn't play in that original band, right? But for some reason, I know I'm good enough to play there. But my God, I'm walking out and I'm like,
this is a good gig.
This is a really cool thing. But
well, I don't deserve to be here. I wasn't there in the original. That's
don't fuck it up.
Don't. That's it. Yeah. It's don't fuck it up every single time. Rather, but now I've done it so much. You know, we've toured with it lots. I can now go, oh, God, this is fun, and I deserve to be there.
Yeah.
But I mean, but I still like, if we have a big break and we go and do a gig, I know I'm going to walk out and I'm going to be like, I don't deserve to be here. This is ridiculous. So, yeah, it's tough, and that imposter syndrome will never go away.
Well, yeah.
Wherever, however far you get.
Yeah, Streisand is the most famous version of it. So she couldn't even perform anymore because she couldn't get on stage because she didn't believe in herself. Barbara Streisand doesn't believe in her own voice. Are you fucking kidding me? Yeah. And so the only way she could overcome it is to build a stage at her ranch and put on performances for people that she knew. And you go, that, well, if she doesn't believe in herself, what the fuck hope do I have? You know, but you just have to, and you know, and you should. And also, there's something satisfying when you do finish, when you're recording something, and you just finish that track.
Yeah,
and you go, right, I think that's done now. Something really satisfying about it, and it's that's, I think that's what I live for, that those moments. And you, and the, I was thinking about your recording your serious songs, which is something I did recently. I've done comedy songs my whole life, written hundreds and hundreds of comedy songs, have albums with the Juice Pigs, done this, and I finally recorded it. It was so satisfying, and it was different. It's not great, and I didn't have enough money to make it really great, you know, but I had friends brought in, and it was really satisfying, and it's something I'm really proud of. And I've not even tried to pitch it or sell it to anyone. I'm just kind of sits there in a thing, as a thing I did, which just makes me, songs that I'd written like 10 years ago, suddenly I hear them with the full backing track, so you should do that as well.
Yeah.
Here, I'm such a good director. Yeah, I do will. That. Yeah, you're really good. Yeah. Do that. Yeah.
I will.
Do an album.
Amy, can we hear you play?
Yes.
That would be amazing.
Yeah, we're on our part, as part of the podcast, we got our guests to sing a little song or do a number or something. So could you like to do that?
Yeah, this is my pretentious hipster song.
Okay.
Perfect.
And I've never done a performance on a sofa before, so this will be something new for me as well. Possibly not the best posture, sort of playing a piano like a sort of drunken 2 a.m. with a glass of wine. Not that I do that, because it's very bad for my voice, as
course,
I've said. Okay,
yes, of course.
So the setup that I do when I'm performing this live is, I say, during lockdown I started doing music producing. I produce my own music. It's not as hard as it looks. All you need is loads of expensive equipment and loads of talent. So I made a few demos, and I've sent them off to people like Avicii, Dizzy Rascal, David Bowie. None of them have replied, but it's not going to stop me. So today I thought I'd share with you my process. Everyone's got a different process, but this is my process. So step one, I always like to get in the zone by putting on a beanie, which I'm going to do now.
Oh, nice beanie.
Very nice beanie.
Thank you. Have you got an acting degree?
I do, yeah.
For people listening at home, I did not put on a beanie. I pretended. I didn't bring it, and quite frankly, it ruins my curls, so fuck it. Sorry, guys. Step one, insert beanie. Step two, insert fat bass into the laptop. PH 80. Step two, add a sick beat. Oh, okay. Step three, add pretentious vocals. Step five, add pretentious lyrics. I tasted the moon and I waited. Pink is now the color of my sea. I reached for the sun and I waited for planet Earth to stop dividing me. Step six, add a rap. I've been making music on my laptop in my bedroom with Indian fabric as a backdrop. Taught myself tech because this girl can, and I like to show it off on Instagram. I choose to wear a hat even when it's hot. Trousers so short you can see my sock. I recycle, I reuse, and I'm very ethical, but I fly abroad once a year for a music festival. My clothes are vintage with a big logo. I carry a skateboard, I can't ride it though. I sit in a cafe and I draw a sketch, wondering what houseplant I'll buy next. Step 7, twist knobs. Possibly not funny if you're listening at home.
That's, I love your knob twirling.
So this is how I do it for you guys watching. For the three people watching, I make it really like
knobs being twisted. Yeah. Arms being thrown in the air. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, twist, more twisting. Mouth closed. Mouth closed. Oh, face.
Scrunch face.
Scrunch face.
Scrunch face, loving my own music face.
Just taking so much of your energy.
Oh, keyboard nearly fell on the floor. Okay, final step. Nod your head to your own song, and as the song ends, don't smile.
Yes, it's a hit. I do really say that as well.
Says the man who couldn't hear it.
Yeah, I know. Actor.
Really, the acting skills are really coming across now. I
didn't hear any of that.
He didn't have his headphones on.
But I did convince you.
Because I've got them, I think.
You do? You do?
But hopefully
I had the headphones in and I enjoyed it. That was absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much, Amy.
Amy Webber, thanks for joining us. Songs in the Key of Laugh. We say goodbye to you. There's a sting out, and then
we say goodbye.
Okay. That was Amy Webber.
That
was Amy Webber. No, I'm now acting. That was this. I'm showing you what we would have done.
Okay.
Oh, no, but that was Amy Webber. That was it. It's Amy Webber.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Well, that's staying in.
Goodbye, adios, farewell. You'll be glad to hear that we think that your interview went well. But we have other things to get on with now, so you're gonna have to go. I'm sure our paths will cross again, but whoever really knows? It's been fun, it's been musical, it's been comical at times. But now we have to leave you, so goodbye, goodbye.
That was Amy Webber, and mark my words, David, she's going to be a huge star.
Amazing. That was Amy Webber, and that was the end of episode 2.
And what an episode. UFOs, 1950s comedy songs.
OAPs,
flying through the air, and our nativity, which, who knows where that's going.
Absolutely.
We'll come back. Jesus, it did. If you'd like to see more or hear more of Amy Webber, why not visit Amy on her website, amywebber.co.uk, or at her Instagram, at Amy Webber Comedian.
If you'd like to support our podcast, please do.
Yes.
And go to patreon.com/songsinthekeyoflaugh.
Or coffee.com/songsinthekeyoflaugh.
Please keep on sending in your comedy songs for our comedy song competition at songsinthekeyoflaugh@gmail.com. We'll see you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.